The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Is it time to give the Carabao Cup box to Manchester City 4 years in a row as they absolutely hammer Spurs 1-0? Ryan Mason's managerial win percentage sensationally halved in one afternoon. What now for Kane and Son? Did Manchester City have more players on the pitch, or are they just really, really good at football? In ESL news, Florentino Perez says the 12 can't leave now, while we ask what sanctions should they get. In the Premier League, Chelsea take the box seat for the top four. As we learn, players can now get sent off for kicking the ball. Quite the issue. A great point for Steve Bruce at Anfield while Burnley score 4 goals in one game. There's a goalkeeper going up for a corner in Scotland. Really good title races in Spain and France. Stuff getting sorted in the EFL. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson. Hello.
Morning. How are you doing?
I am very well. Thank you very much. Nicky Bandini, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? You've already answered that question, but it's just instinctive. Like, I want to ask you back.
I'm as well as I was when Jonathan Wilson asked me some seconds ago. And Herb Turbo writes, on Thursday's pod, Barry referred to the cynical, jaded part of himself. Does that imply that we're normally hearing from the upbeat, optimistic part of him?
Hello, Max.
Nice to see you, Barry. Let's start then at Wembley. Manchester City 1, Tottenham Hotspur 0. Their fourth consecutive League Cup, their eighth in total. They now have the joint record most wins alongside Liverpool. And Schumann says, should all the other clubs playing in the League Cup break away to form a different cup competition and leave City alone in the Carabao? Because what's the point anyway? Christopher, what is the smallest margin of victory to classify the winners a Mullering? May just have to be one goal now. Nicky, City was so good yesterday, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was about as much of a 1-0 thrashing as you could have. I know that my brain is making me start on expected goals, but there was that extraordinary statistic that Tottenham had 0.04 expected goals. They'd had to add a decimal place for how few expected goals they'd had in this game. Yeah, it was odd because City took so long to get that goal, there was almost still some possibility of tension for quite a long time in the game, which was good because it was, it's the most interested, being just totally frank, I've been in a Carabao Cup final for some time. I'm not someone who's normally getting particularly wound up and excited for a Carabao Cup final, but just the fact that there were fans inside that stadium made this something interesting. It made it something that felt like it meant more after a year and a bit of football that to me has often felt very hollow. Just that feeling of, even if it's only fewer than 8,000 people, it's still something. And I don't know if that contributed as well, but as long as it was 0-0, it felt like it was still some kind of game. But looking at it with the knowledge of the final result, the knowledge that Tottenham didn't pull that rabbit out of a hat out of nowhere, it was a total mismatch. It was not a close or contested game of football, almost.
It's funny watching it from a Spurs perspective that you were thinking, well, hang on, you know, Dyer's played well, Alderweireld's played well, Lloris has had a brilliant game, Aurier has been brilliant. It was basically, the script was then that Spurs somehow won it with a Harry Kane goal or something like that. So then for Spurs to lose it with Aurier giving away a free kick he didn't need to give away, and then Sissoko just not following his runner, was, Barry, I would say, quite Spursy.
Well, I said on Thursday that my worry, I kind of said it in jest, was that Spurs, Harry Kane would not be fit to play, but he would be selected anyway, probably having passed himself fit to play and not contribute anything. And that's exactly what happened. And that's not the first time it's happened, Spurs in a final. And I don't know whether to admire Kane for his determination to get in the field or to accuse him of sort of sabotaging his team's chances by taking up a place in the side when he clearly wasn't fit. And Manchester City probably would have won anyway. They were vastly superior in almost every department. But you have to give yourself every chance of winning. And Spurs didn't do that. And Harry Kane, I think, has to take some responsibility for that again. And I appreciate he wants to win trophies. He wants to play in big finals. But he, Ryan Mason said before the game that Harry Kane had told him he was fit enough to play. And I, that wasn't true. He wasn't fit enough to play. And he should have stood himself down, in my opinion. And that's, if I was a Tottenham fan, I'd be a bit angry over that, I think.
But, can I just check that everyone thought, because the stats would suggest that he didn't attempt a shot or create a single chance for Spurs in the game. The first time he's done neither while playing for more than 45 minutes since September 2018. But I actually thought he didn't look unfit. I just thought Spurs just never had the ball and they tried to play out and they couldn't because City was so good. But am I the only one there who thought actually Harry Kane maybe wasn't 100%, but I don't think that was a deciding factor.
I don't think it was decisive. I mean, Spurs didn't have the ball, so maybe he's fit, maybe he wasn't. I just don't really think the evidence was there one way or the other. I understand why it's a question. You sort of think, you know, you think back to Madrid 2 years ago and the fact he was clearly not fully fit then, particularly when Tottenham had played so well in the weeks leading up to that final without him back then. This time, I mean, you think back to that Everton game, which is only, what, a week on Friday, it feels like about 150 years ago, given everything that's happened since. And Kane was the only player playing for Tottenham that day. So I understand the determination to push him in if he's even vaguely fit. But I just, yeah, that wasn't, yeah, maybe he could have moved more. Maybe he could have been more alert with the movement. But City just dominated three midfields that Tottenham could never get the ball to him. And the one time when I did sort of think, oh, maybe he is actually fit, maybe he is sort of, it is right he's playing, was when he drew the yellow card for Ruben Dias, which they seem to think on TV wasn't a particularly bad foul, but it seemed to me quite obvious that Dias clipped his ankle before he took the ball. And it was one of those fouls where it's a dangerous decision to attempt the foul from, and therefore it's an attempt for the tackle from, and therefore it's a yellow card. But the way he turned and accelerated away then, I thought he looked okay. But, you know, he wasn't involved for whatever reason.
Maybe you could make a case that 100% Harry Kane, again, it's just pulling a rabbit out of a hat somewhere, does something because he's got that superior edge of sharpness, because he's a flipping great striker. And as Barney wrote in his column, you know, is perhaps the only thing missing from that Manchester City team is a Harry Kane. So maybe if he's completely on top of his game, something happens that you don't expect. But in terms of influencing the game isn't decided by that, at least the structure of the game. The game is decided by the fact that you've got Harry Winks and the rest of that Tottenham midfield chasing shadows for the whole game. You've got Foden, who just seems to be moving at a different frame rate sometimes, seems to be moving on a different mode almost to everyone else out there. And you've got Mahrez, who's giving everyone the run. You've got De Bruyne, who's always spectacular. I don't think that Kane is the reason Tottenham didn't win this game. I think they didn't win this game because they were manifestly worse than a really good Man City side. I think we probably haven't said that enough yet. Man City were brilliant and are brilliant.
I should add, I don't think that's the reason Tottenham lost either, but I still think you need to give yourself every chance against a City team that good. And they needed City to have an off day and they simply didn't.
Fernandinho has won 6 League Cups since 2013. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
The Ashley Cole of the League Cup.
Yeah. How do you? What do you do then, Wilson? You know, against City, apart from just hope, or just hope they aren't very, because they weren't great last week, were they, against Chelsea?
Well, I mean, ideally you'd play them in Champions League quarter final. That seems the easiest way of beating them. But failing that, City have this great weakness that we all know about, that if you can play through the press or play over the press or somehow bypass the press, they are vulnerable to balls played in behind them. And you know, I think we mentioned before this idea that that's the fatal flaw. But I don't think it is a fatal flaw in the way that, we're going back on the Star Wars analogy, that the exhaust vent on the Death Star is a fatal flaw. That flaw is inherent in the philosophy. The reason it's so hard to play through the press is because the press is so high, but by playing the press so high, there is space behind them. And so you have what's the word? I don't think it is a paradox. You have this sort of discrepancy where they can look like they have a really good defensive record because 17 of the other 19 teams in the league aren't good enough to play through that press or to bypass that press. But the two who are, once they do it, City are quite vulnerable. And that's the problem they keep coming up against in Europe. And it's what they'll have to deal with against PSG on Wednesday. And that's going to be fascinating because PSG is so good on the break, not just with Neymar and Mbappe, but Di Maria, I think, is in his use of the ball on the break, is one of the most intelligent players probably there's ever been. And if you think back to when Real Madrid beat Guardiola's Bayern in 2014, was it? And it was Di Maria who pulled the strings that day. It was him orchestrating the breaks. So that front three, plus Draxler as well, presumably, will be incredibly difficult for City to deal with. And that maybe they can't, we don't know. But that's just not a challenge Tottenham can pose them, because Tottenham aren't good enough.
I think that's like a super interesting point. And what sort of raises the stakes almost, I mean, not like the stakes can be much higher, it's Champions League semi-final, but makes this sort of such an intense moment for City is, Pep talked about it in his post-game press conference a bit when someone asked him about the goal and he was like, oh, was that a set piece that you've worked on? He said, we don't have time to work on set pieces. Like, it's not a thing we have time for. Like, we're just dealing with the next game, doing the next thing over and over again. And every player at every club that is in these competitions now is knackered. Like, they just are. Like, they're all pushing through it because they are elite professionals and they've been doing this their whole lives towards these moments. But everyone has played this sort of dual season with almost no break, with lots of games, and teams like City that go to Carabao Cup finals over and over again have played more than anyone else. And I think that's almost feels like the one thing that can still catch this team out is whether or not it has the legs to go against a team like PSG over two legs after this season. And of course, the same goes the other way as well. But I think when you play that high press, you do take on that risk. And one thought that came into my head actually was, what is the impact again, without wanting to ham it up, because maybe you guys will disagree and say it doesn't matter, but how much of an impact again is it, like a psychological boost of doing this in front of some fans? Because I think that really has been a thing the longer these seasons have gone on. Some teams have dealt with that mental part of not having any external push better than others. And I wonder if that helps, like getting a little moment of, okay, we're not just doing this in a bubble. We are sort of part of something and we've got something extra motivating us.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And look, Cambridge United won at Leyton Orient with 12 of us watching, lost at home to Stevenage on Saturday with nobody watching. So that, I mean, that proof if you needed it. Here for the footy says, if I shed a tear at the sight of Heung-min Son shedding tears in a pile on the pitch, can I still maintain my self-respect as an Arsenal supporter to the extent that that's possible in itself? It's a very moving moment, actually. And I do wonder what is next for Kane and Son, Barry, because they've got, you know, they've got to go, haven't they? If they're allowed to.
Well, I presume it depends on whether or not they want to go. I think Kane probably will call it a day at Tottenham. And yeah, Son is clearly a very emotional guy, clearly cares very deeply about results. And, you know, there was a time not too long ago when people thought he would be leaving Spurs. I think it was when they signed Lucas Moura, but he's been one of their best players since. It all depends on his personal ambition, presumably. And He clearly cares about winning trophies, so yeah, maybe he will leave. And the Tottenham team would be all the poorer for his absence.
I think a huge amount depends on what assurances they get about who the new manager is. Because you know, Kane's 27, Son's 28. Both of them have contracts that run out in the year in which they're 30. So Son's runs out in 2 years, Kane's in three. Which means that they would command some kind of fee, but we've got no idea what's going to happen to fees in the new economic market. You know, I mean, one of the key drivers of the Super League proposals was that all the major clubs have lost huge amounts of money over the last 18 months. So I just don't think we're going to see massive fees, and we might not even see a 50 million fee for Harry Kane. Now, if that's the case, if I were Daniel Levy, I'd take the gamble on Kane not sulking rather than accepting sort of 40 million, 45 million for him. You know, I think for 3 years, you try and keep him and you try and get him recommitted. And the extent to which you can get somebody recommitted, I think depends on on who the new manager is and whether he's a figure who excites and makes the squad believe that there is a bright future rather than that they're on an inevitable downslope.
The favourite is Maurizio Sarri at the moment for that job. Nicky, what do you make of that?
I mean, I'll stick up for Sarri as a sort of a tactical manager. I know not everyone at Chelsea was enamoured with him. I think that what's happened at Juventus in the last year has been a very stark lesson in actually you can't just put anyone in charge of some of these clubs and trust that they'll know what they're doing. Sarri was not a face that fit in Turin, and I don't know that he'd be a face that would fit at Tottenham, but again, it's a different for different reasons. But I think he's no mug. I can't think of a sort of a neater way to put it than that. Like he's okay. I don't know that I find him the sort of manager, despite that, that is going to do exactly what Jonathan just said. Now, I think that the Harry Kane situation, personally, I just can't see, for exactly the reasons Jonathan just said, can't see Daniel Levy selling him. Daniel Levy is not someone who lets assets leave at a value that is below what he perceives them to be worth. And so in this market, who's going to buy him? But if you're looking for a manager who's going to get Harry Kane thinking, yes, we're on the right track, Sarri doesn't have that reputation. He's not carried that sort of reputation with him really anywhere since Napoli, and certainly not in the Premier League. So I don't think he would tick that box. I slightly struggle to see it. I don't think that's going to be who does end up there, but I also don't really know who will. And if I was looking at, if I was looking at an Italian manager, I would have thought Max Allegri would be top of that list ahead of Sarri personally. And I think his face would fit much more. And he really wants to have a go in the Premier League. Having said all that, I think he'll end up back at Juventus.
I mean, I think the problem with Sarri, it's not really anything to do with him or his management. If he goes to Tottenham, there'll be a sense that, oh, he's Chelsea's cast off. That's the big problem. In the same way that VH Boas was Chelsea's cast off. So I just sort of, and it's the, in a sense, it's the wrong way to approach these things, but you do sense that Tottenham just need some sort of injection of vitality, and that means an exciting young manager. I guess Allegri can still fit that because his record was so good at Juve, or one of the bright young Germans, because bright young Germans are the fashionable thing at the minute.
On the European Super League, obviously both City and Spurs, part of the Evil Six, Florentino Perez said, "I don't need to explain what a binding contract is, but effectively the clubs cannot leave. Some of them, due to pressure, have said they're leaving. But this project, or one very similar, will move forward, and I hope very soon." UEFA boss Alexander Šefčovič was completely impressed by the supporters' reaction to the concept and said sanctions for the six English clubs would be the most lenient because they left first. Juve, Barca and Real would get stronger punishment. What punishment should the 12 get, Barry?
Well, there has been talk of them getting relegated, which I don't see happening. This is on the domestic front.
How good would the championship be then, though?
Well, only three could come back up, isn't so? But I would, entirely for my own amusement, I do think they should be punished, and I would dock them each 20 points start of next season just to make a really, really interesting league title out of it. Fine them. And I don't really care whether they're banned from Europe or not for a season or two, but I definitely think they should be punished, and they should be punished quite harshly.
Nicky?
I love the idea that the point stocking is also just about making it a more interesting championship. Could we make it like golf where there's a handicap or something?
Yeah.
And so from now on, City have to start 20 points back just so that there's a chance for anyone else. Look, it's really interesting. What Šefčovič says about the English clubs is interesting because in Italy, there's actually been this conversation that maybe Inter are going to get off lighter from any punishments because they hadn't actually, for all this talk of binding contracts, finished the sign-up process because they were waiting for sign-off from their own shareholders. So technically they weren't signed up, so can they get more leniency? In Italy, there's been 11 Serie A clubs have written to the league president saying, we want punishments. It's really interesting which clubs didn't sign that letter. Some of the ones who you'd think would benefit most directly from a punishment, Napoli, Lazio, Atalanta, none of those clubs signed this letter. So it's definitely up in the air whether anything's going to happen in Italy. What I think should happen, I really struggle with this one because I think that the punishment, if you want the punishment to fit the crime, then the punishment should really target very strongly the owners. Certainly, again, with the Italian clubs, it's striking how some of the directors had no idea this was even happening. People like Paolo Maldini, who's a director responsible for the technical area. I mean, I'm sorry, something is beeping past my window, which might be coming through. You know, he's got a position of responsibility at Milan, and he had no idea this was happening. It's that much that it's been sort of orchestrated at a level above. And so if you're really looking to punish those people, then I feel like the way to go after them is either with huge fines, but they would have to be huge because some of those people have such wealth that what are you going to fine them? 30,000 euros, they're not going to notice it. Or it has to be some sort of punishment that impacts their ability to, frankly, own these clubs in a way that has no responsibility to their clubs. Wouldn't it be better if the punishment could somehow push us towards what all of us want to see, which is a model of ownership that doesn't allow people to have this sort of untrammeled power where they can act like this? Now, I don't know what that looks like, but I think it's something more complicated than a points deduction.
Jonathan?
Well, I mean, I understand the urge for punishment, and I can see that a small points deduction may make some kind of sense. I think there is also a danger, though, of ostracising these clubs to making it very much of them and us. I think at this stage, it has to be about bringing them back in the fold. I think those executives should lose their positions on whatever committees, that they should lose that direct power. But I also think that there should be some new charter drawn up, both for UEFA and for the Premier League and Serie A and La Liga, where it is very clear what the sanction for this kind of behaviour in the future is. And you know, so you know, if you sign up to some breakaway Super League, you will lose 30 points. And that is written in stone. And it's not, you don't require a three-quarters majority to enact that. That is just what happens. And the great thing with that is then the clubs would have to sign up to it, or all the apologies we saw last week would just sound like absolute nonsense. So
they sounded like absolute nonsense anyway.
Yeah, but it will be forcing them to acknowledge that those apologies were cant, and it would be protecting the league for the future. And that, I think, is probably more important at this stage than enacting the very understandable urge to punish them.
A merciful Winston is no Wilson at all.
It's not. No. This isn't being merciful. This is being clever to ensure that my revenge is long and drawn out, and in 30 years, I'm still victorious.
It's those apologies where they say, we will learn from this, that I always go, I know that you have to say that. When JP Morgan said, we'll learn from this, I very much, the replies to that tweet were great, weren't they? Class from a Lehman Brothers man. You know, that. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up. Not a particularly fascinating weekend in the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start the London Stadium, then West Ham 0, Chelsea 1. Important win in the race for the top four. Mojo says, do VAR officials practice making decisions by watching retro games master clips of spotty teenagers playing FIFA 94 on the Sega Mega Drive, as that's the last time I saw a player kick the ball and not have the natural leg movement following through. Kade says, since we've decided over the past year that defenders should not have arms, should we now discuss if it's okay for defenders to clear the ball? His straight red after booting the ball miles and then catching Ben Chilwell on the thigh with his follow through. Chris Kavanagh watched a replay on the pitch side monitor before dismissing him for serious foul play. But does anybody want to say that this was a correct decision by the letter of the law?
No, but what I will say is that football's been sorting up this problem for ages, that the follow-through is now a thing like a handball where we have no idea what it is anymore, because we used to have a sense that you would see in real time two players going for a ball and one of them might get hurt, one of them might not, and you would somehow know from the body language and the momentum of both if an offence had been committed and by whom. But now we slow it down, and you see contact, and suddenly it's a foul one way or the other. You see a whole load of players get booked for going in to block a clearance, and the clearance follows through and hits them, and they are the ones who get booked for it. Now, clearly, if you raise your studs into a player cleaving the ball in such a way that you know his leg is going to hit yours, that is dangerous, and that probably is a booking. But every time you go to block to close it down, shouldn't be a booking. And equally, making 100% clean contact on the ball, but then carrying on to somebody who's approached you after you began the kicking motion, is just not an offence. Now, again, clearly there are times, and you look back at, say, the Ryan Shawcross one on Aaron Ramsey, where what was, I'm sure, a deliberate, you know, a genuine attempt to clear the ball is so rash and badly mistimed that it is an offence. But those things are really, they're just much better judged in the moment because you get a sense of how everybody's moving. So, it's a nonsense. And it's a nonsense that is brought about by slow motion and reviewing things and reviewing them and reviewing them.
Nicky, you've admonished me in the past for just going, just get rid of VAR. Maybe it isn't VAR. Maybe it's the law again. Just put me right, Nicky. What am I meant to think?
You're meant to think whatever you want to think, Max. I'm not
okay,
here
thank you.
to be your mum and tell you what to think. Look, the thing I keep thinking with the VAR, and I'm not going to pretend for a moment that it's been all happiness and rainbows in Italy, because it hasn't. But I do find that the level of sort of minutiae scrutiny has been so much more intense here in England. And to me, that is going to keep coming back for as long as we have this conversation to application. Like, Italy has had some disagreements over VAR, but we haven't had these week-long debates about wobbly lines and offsides. We haven't had this sort of constant overanalyzing. And I think that's a choice that you make. And I think that there is sort of a level of the sort of clear and obvious that has been sort of taken way beyond in the Premier League. And I don't know why that's happened. I don't know if that's something to do with the sporting culture, if that's to do with the individuals who are applying it. But I do think the attitude has been different.
So does that challenge, if that challenge happens in Serie A,
I can't speak to one individual challenge because it depends on the referees who are there on the day. And of course, yeah, it's inherent in VAR and will always be the case that on a given day, an official can make a decision after viewing the replay footage that is at odds with the public opinion. That's going to be true whether or not we have VAR. There's going to be moments, even without a replay, where a referee will say, no, I saw that crystal clear, I'm certain of my decision, and a lot of us will watch it and go, I think it's wrong. I agree that this didn't look like a foul to me, and I can't point to some pattern in Italy and say, oh no, we're awarding this as a free kick now. But I don't want to say, oh, that would never be given as a free kick, because someone will probably go and find a video of a game where it did. So I just, I think that's the thing which I get as my feeling from this, is that the mentality just seems to be different. And for whatever reason, it's being more intensely applied over here.
Barry, Chelsea deserved this win anyway, didn't they? 10th clean sheet in 14 Premier League games for Thomas Tuchel. Timo Werner breaking his goal drought.
Yeah, he broke his goal drought, and I was pleased for him. And then he began his next goal drought in fine style by missing an absolute sitter. But the red card has overshadowed the fact that Chelsea were very worthy winners of this game. West Ham had a couple of chances, but they can have a very big complaint insofar as they had a man unjustly sent off, but otherwise they were worthy losers of this one.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed Timo Werner's interview afterwards. Seems like he doesn't really, he's not that, I mean, he's sort of bothered, but he's like, it's okay. Like when he sort of said, well, if I'd scored two, that would have frankly been ridiculous after the run I've been on.
But then he immediately clarified that it was a joke. He was like, that's a joke. Don't take me wrong.
Yeah.
Well, he kind of has to do that, isn't he? Because there are people out there who will pounce on it and take it seriously. I mean, he hasn't plumbed Rian Brewster levels of inadequacy this season. He scored quite a few goals. He scored for Germany. He scored, I think is he in double figures for Chelsea? He's not far off it if he isn't. And he has provided a lot of assists and posed opposition defences a lot of problems. So, I mean, if this is the worst spell he ever goes through in his career, he'll be doing okay.
Liverpool 1, Newcastle 1. Richard says, Liverpool have thrown away four leads at 12:30 on a Saturday on BT Sport this season, three involving injury time disasters. Was Klopp's biggest mistake starting a feud with Des Kelly? Jurgen Klopp Wilson said, if you deserve, you deserve it. I didn't see us today playing like we deserve Champions League next year. I'm sure if you went back and listened to a pod sort of early in the season, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, that they're not particularly timeless, are they? But I've definitely said, well, Liverpool are walking away with the league again. To think of them not getting in the top four is pretty staggering, isn't it?
Yeah, extraordinary. I mean, I think my thinking through the autumn and early winter was, yeah, Liverpool aren't playing particularly well, but they're clearly the best side in the league because City had, or was it their worst start to a season in 12 years, I think? And there were a lot of problems with City. And then suddenly, mid-December, City start winning and then won 23 out of 24, whatever it was in the league. And then Liverpool, they went to Palace, won 7-0, and we sort of thought, it's all clicked, they'll be fine. And then they didn't win another game didn't win another home game for, 2 months? That collapse, I think, has been astonishing. But I guess you see how even at that level, confidence plays a huge part. And I think, we said this before, that particularly with pressing, confidence is huge because it is a counterintuitive thing to do. The idea that you defend by running forwards is not what your brain's telling you to do. If you're doubtful, you hang back. And if you hang back, you end up getting outplayed like Real Madrid outplayed them in the first half of the first leg of that Champions League quarterfinal. So I can see why they are particularly susceptible to doubt.
5 out of 27 points at Anfield since the turn of the year. Does that happen with fans there? I find it really hard to believe that it would. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but it seems to me like that's something that is so particular to right now.
Liverpool have only taken 5 points out of 18 in their home games against the bottom six. That's a remarkable stat.
It's amazing. Mike says, not a question. Just want to say to Barry that I'm a Newcastle fan and I'm happy with our last few results. Lads are playing well. No ifs, buts or throwing blame around. Can't complain when we're taking points off Super League teams. And also credit to them for going again after Callum Wilson had that goal disallowed in the 93rd minute. Kind of thought, might as well give up then. And actually, Joe Linton turned a man inside out before getting a shot away. So, big hope for Newcastle under Steve Bruce next season.
They played well, and Callum Wilson should have got a penalty. After the goal was ruled out for handball, which a handball he could do absolutely nothing about, he was shoved in the back by Trent Alexander-Arnold in the build-up, and Joe Linton should have had a penalty as well, because I think Trent Alexander-Arnold jumped into the back of him. So a draw is probably fair, and Newcastle could be justified in thinking they should have won.
Thank goodness Trent Alexander-Arnold won't be giving away any penalties in the Euros, eh? Arsenal 0, Everton 1. Everton's run of 6 games without a win in all competitions is over after their first win at Arsenal in 25 years. You can't rule them out of the top four, or can you?
Yeah, Barry? I can.
Yes, you can, Wilson. I can. I thought someone would say that. It was an amazing mistake from Bernd Leno, Nicky, wasn't it? I don't think Richarlison should have really done I've scored a goal dance like that after that mistake. How are you feeling generally about Mikel Arteta and Arsenal?
I mean, I think the problem is it would be amazing if it wasn't just that these things feel so inevitable at the moment. Yeah. I don't know. It's been very hard for a long time to feel enthusiastic about watching Arsenal games this season. The Europa League has been a pleasant distraction, and there's been some fun individual bits and pieces like Smith Rowe, but the team has not been on any sort of clear trajectory towards better, and that is a pretty damning reflection on Arteta. Like, there hasn't been progress, but I do find this season so particular, so specific. And if he were to come out of it winning the Europa League, which in the end is only 3 games away, you aren't going to drop him after that, are you? So it's still a very much an impartial verdict.
I bumped into a fella I know. He sort of drinks in my local pub, or used to when it was still allowed to open. and he's a big Arsenal fan, season ticket holder. So he went down to the Emirates for the protest before that game and met with his mates and had a few cans and went home and described it as the perfect Arsenal experience, because he had all the perks of going to the game without actually having to watch the game.
Wolves 0, Burnley 4. Adam says, has there ever been a more Burnley striker than Chris Wood? I mean, I would have said Ashley Barnes straight away, but you know, well done to him. Time for a great quiz, everybody. Chris Wood is the first player from New Zealand to score a Premier League hat-trick, with New Zealand now the 46th different nation to be represented by a hat-trick scorer in the competition. 22 nations have only had one scorer, okay? So if I give you the country, can you give me the player? Okay.
Oh, my
Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan Wilson sits up straight. I think Barry and Nikki, you
I'm
can
just,
relax.
I'm just ready.
I'm just
going
to let Jonathan do this, yeah.
Hello, okay. Wanchope, I'm ready to come in with straight away.
Okay,
so he's just like, hello, Wanchope.
Here we go then. Here are the 22 countries from which one player has scored a Premier League hat-trick. Algeria.
Yeah, Mahrez.
Correct.
Was that against Sunderland? I think it was against Sunderland.
I don't have the detail. No, it's going to be a long enough quiz as it is. Australia.
Tim Cahill.
No.
Mark Viduka.
Not Tim Cahill.
Correct. Barry's got a point. Yeah. Barry, you can sit down and relax now. Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Edin Dzeko.
Correct.
Can I get a half point?
Yeah, you can. Bulgaria.
Berbatov.
Chile.
Sanchez.
Correct.
Oh. Yeah.
Costa Rica.
Padawanchop.
Point for Barry.
What?
DR Congo.
Balassi.
Correct. Egypt.
Mido.
Salah.
Mido, great guess. It is Mo Salah. the former Republic of Yugoslavia.
Milosevic.
Correct. Gabon.
Aubameyang.
Ghana.
Are you?
No.
Jam.
No.
It can't be Essien.
No. This is a good
one. I cannot think of a single Ghanaian.
The greatest Premier League goal ever?
Tony Boa.
Correct.
Oh, of course.
Oh.
Is Israel.
Berkovic.
Ben Ayoun,
yes. This is tricky. Jamaica.
It's not the Sunderland fella. What's his name? Dread.
I can't give you that. I can't give it for that.
It's not Kenwyn Jones. Is it Kenwyn Jones?
No.
Should he not?
No. I might give this to you, otherwise we'll be on forever. Charlton he played for.
Oh, Marcus.
No.
No.
Kevin Lisby.
Oh, of course, yeah.
God.
Japan.
Inamoto?
No. You've never sounded more Macam in your whole life. Inamoto?
Not the Carters.
No.
This feels like it should be really obvious.
It's pretty obvious.
It feels like it should be, but I can't.
Oh, the Leicester guy.
No.
the Leicester
Okazawa,
guy.
I meant, but obviously.
It's not Okazaki, no.
Okazaki.
He played for Manchester United.
Yeah, I was thinking, I can't think of the name. I actually
Kagawa.
Can picture him.
Yes, correct.
Yes, yeah.
New Zealand.
Chris
Wood.
Yes. Okay, not long to go now. Paraguay.
Lucky Santa Cruz?
Yep. Oh. South Korea.
Son?
Yep. Sweden.
Larsson?
No.
Ibrahimovic?
No.
Ljungberg?
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Togo?
Adebayor.
Yep. Trinidad and Tobago?
Dwight York?
Yep. Uruguay?
Forlan?
No.
Cavani?
No.
Suarez?
Yes. And we finish with the greatest footballer in the world from Venezuela.
That would be Salomon Rondon.
Correct.
Who was born
on
the 16th of September.
Right, there we are. Wilson 14, Barry 5, Nikki 2 apparently.
I got more than that. That's not right. I'm going to do a recount afterwards. I'm certain I got in on a couple before.
I want a point for Luis Suarez. I just couldn't think of his name. But
that's quite key to quizzes. Like, you don't see that in the University Challenge. I knew it.
Darren Bench would have done very well on Celebrity Mastermind.
Oh, I tell you, it's a bald fellow with the ruff and the Shakespeare, that's the one.
We should say well done to Ashley Westwood because he scored a lovely goal. I don't think he's ever been mentioned on the pod before. And Liam, who is a sort of Burnley influencer, if there's such a thing, said a photo of Burnley being 4-0 up and keeping the ball in the corner is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. But yeah, good win for Burnley. They're probably safe. Brighton are probably safe. They lost at Sheffield United. They're 7 points clear. 17 shots, no goals. Played lovely football. Couldn't score. Do we want to cut and paste an answer from a previous podcast? Aston Villa 2, West Brom 2. Jonathan, you only found out an hour ago this game even happened.
Yeah. I think I had some sense around about lunchtime yesterday it was going to happen, but then I just got distracted by basically finishing off work from the Carabao Cup final and getting my dinner ready before line of duty, and I just sort of forgot about it. And I know it finished 2-2 because I looked at the score before we began, because I'm not a complete amateur, but as to exactly what happened, I can't tell you.
It was probably the best game of the weekend, actually. But
oh, great.
It's not a Sunday night should be sacrosanct. We don't want football on a Sunday night, do we?
Yeah.
But it was.
If it makes you feel better, if it makes you feel better, Wilson, Barry didn't know it was on when I asked him live on air yesterday.
Not the first time that kind of thing's happened, though, is it?
It was a bit of a sickness for West Brom, Baz, wasn't it? But perhaps, you know, that mistake from Carl Bartley at the end, you know, just get rid. Don't try and chest it to your keeper.
Well, everyone was saying this, and I think just getting rid was easier said than done, because the ball was kind of at an awkward height for him and he's static. And I'm not sure how exactly, it's very easy to say just get rid, but I physically not sure what he was supposed to do, because he couldn't head it. He couldn't kick it. So short of like trying to chest it out for a corner, I don't know how he was supposed to get rid.
It's really sad for all the listeners. They don't get to see all the sort of actions. It was like the wise man build his house upon the rock, wasn't it? maybe you make a good point. But look, that's
you play football on a regular basis. Was it as straightforward as?
I think he probably could have headed it. Probably. I think he might have been able to hook it with his left peg. But, you know,
I think the ball was just at exactly the right height for who's the young fellow?
Keenan Davis.
And I was pleased to see him score, I must say, because that was only his first Premier League goal. And as he said himself, it's been a long time coming.
He looks like quite a good player, doesn't he? Look, West Brom 9 points from safety, 5 games to go. Seems unlikely now. Leeds 0, Man United 0. Nathan says, has there finally been a Leeds game that Max can't describe as fun? Yes. The thing most people found exciting was that Dean Henderson was wearing a cap. First goalkeeper you think of in a cap?
Oh, I remember Mark Crossley wearing one. Ooh. At one stage.
I'm surprised. I thought it was obviously Bruce Grobbelaar.
Yeah, to say Grobbelaar. Yeah.
Anyway, Luke said, not a question. I really wanted Dean Henderson to come up for a late free kick and be offside by the peak of his cap. Anyway, the result means Manchester City will be crowned Premier League champions next weekend if City beat Palace and United lose at home to Liverpool over the weekend. One final bit of Premier League news. Thierry Henry and Alan Shearer have been, what's the word?
Inaugurated?
Inaugurated, installed. Yes. The first two names, inducted. That's
inducted.
It. Yes. Inducted into the Premier League Hall of Fame. Are you happy with that decision? Obviously, I would have much preferred them just do, John Ebrill and Robert Ullathorne. And just see what the reaction would be. But two reasonably good.
Oh, sorry, I've never understood this. I know they do this in American sports. What's the point?
Oh, just because then people have forgotten they were good at football, Wilson, and now we can remember that they're good.
They should just buy books about them.
That's a good idea, isn't it? Could you recommend any?
Not about those two, in fairness, okay. No. But
sorry.
No, Philippe, sorry, that's very unfair. Philippe's book on Thierry Henry is really good. I'd forgotten about that when I said that, sorry.
I just noticed before we started recording that Matt Law has written an article saying that Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira have joined Daniel Ek in his bid to buy Arsenal, and I am told this is very real. So Daniel Ek being the Spotify guy who will
founder
pay
Spotify, yeah.
Footballers 0.00003p every time they play.
Anyway, it'll be interesting, won't it? Why not? And more on that as we get it.
Or as Matt Law gets it.
More on that as Matt Law gets it. That'll do for part two. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, as you know, it's been a year of not being able to attend live sport. So we've all been missing watching football with our friends and family because it's better when you watch it together. If you're a regular listener, you'll know by now that Football Weekly is sponsored by EE. With the BT Sport app on EE's smart plan, you can use the Watch Together feature to invite three other mates and yourself, of course, to watch the game together on your mobile, wherever you all are in the country. So with the help of EE, we thought we'd take a moment to celebrate the fact that football's better when it's shared, especially with one of the biggest football games coming up, the UEFA Champions League semi-finals on BT Sport. And Wilson, this kind of stemmed from when you talked about going to watch Sunderland at Wembley, actually not with somebody else and on your own, because no one else could go to see you actually win at Wembley. But it made you remember what football actually means to you, and about what it means to all of us, probably, about the relationships that have formed around the game.
It was a reminder that the game exists below the top level. You don't have to be successful for it to be meaningful. And the meaning it has for me, and I think my generation of fans, is that Sunderland, the football club, is this repository for a lot of quite complicated feelings about family and about home. And again, yeah, maybe other people don't have this feeling, but as somebody who left home, well, in 1994 for the first time, and then more concretely in 1999, my real attachment to home and everything home meant is now through football. It was two seasons ago when Sunderland got to Wembley twice for the playoff final and the Chequered Trade final. And Sunderland fans took over Trafalgar Square and Covent Garden. And there was a sense in that, I think, of people saying, we're still here. This is still, Sunderland still exists. Like, we might not have the mines, we might not have the shipyards anymore. We might not matter in an industrial sense in the way we did, but we are still here. And the football club is a way of expressing that. And so that's why I think football matters. And I guess in this last week, that's become particularly relevant given all the talk about the Super League.
Yeah, I sort of struggle to conceive football. And I think it's been a great struggle of this last year, honestly, football without people, because I always worry that I'm going to break some secret football journalist code when I admit this, but I wasn't a kid who grew up obsessed with football, but football was how I connected to my brother. It was how I connected to my family a lot of the time. I mean, one of my first memories of football is the World Cup Italia 90, third and fourth playoff, ridiculously. I was coming up on 7 years old, but it was Italy against England. And I was asked that question of who are you going to support? Because you've got an Italian dad and you've got an English mum. Which side are you on? And I picked Italy and my brother picked England. And it was this sort of thing that we did as a family that, you know, neither my parents cared about football, but it was a thing that made us sort of who we were and part of our identity. And I think then growing up and becoming a teenager, another part of my identity was that I went every week with my brother to go sit in the junior honours section and then in the clock end. And that was who we were and how we knew each other. And I think that is such a fundamental part of football for me, is that it forms those bonds and those relationships that you have all through life.
Yeah. The group of pals I grew up with in Burr in Ireland, small provincial town, I'm still mates with them all now. We have a WhatsApp group going. It's almost entirely about sport. Sport and vaccines, COVID vaccines. And then when I came to London, I literally knew two people in London. So it was quite a lonely place London can be, if you know, even if you do know people. But when you don't know anyone, it can be quite terrifying. And most of the friends I have here now are, you know, our common bonding experience is watching football matches. During the recent break in the pandemic, a gang of mates and I, we went to Dulwich Hamlet to watch a game because we all live around the Brixton area. Dulwich Hamlet was open. The bar at Dulwich Hamlet was open. We went, had a great time. Our main aim, to be honest, was to lorry back as many pints as was humanly possible between 6:30 and 10 o'clock in the evening. But the fact that there happened to be a football match on with lots of people at it just made for a really fun evening. And you forget how much fun it can be to go to a game. So sport in general and football in particular has been a huge part of helping me settle in London as someone who originally came over not knowing a soul, barely.
It's interesting you say that whether the game itself is the relevant part of it. I think Cambridge United doing well this season. I've obviously still followed it, but I haven't been going that much because I play on a Saturday, right? But we used to go every single week, you know, from like 5 years old, taken me, Matthew and Clive, taken by our dads. And then a few more of us when we were like 16, 17, when we were sort of big enough to go and stand behind the goal. We used to sit and look at the Newmarket Road end and think, God, you'd have to be pretty tough to be in there, as if behind the goal at Cambridge United is, you know, Galatasaray, you know, and it's all those sort of things. It's not actually the football that happens that makes a difference. And also I had that moment, Barry, which you have teased me about mercilessly after watching Spurs beat Ajax in the semi-final of the Champions League and being blown away, but having a ticket for that game. And then having basically an existential crisis that evening and getting quite emotional about Spurs basically being about my relationship with my dad. And then having to forego the ticket, saying I couldn't go because I had to watch it with my dad. And essentially my dad probably not being half as bothered as I was. And then flying to Madrid for a night out with some friends and flying back on the day of the game. And then my dad saying the trains had all been cancelled, so he couldn't get there. And me saying, well, listen, I've written an article in The Guardian about this now. You've got to come.
Your poor father had to go out in the cold.
No, it wasn't the cold. It was about 40 degrees. He had to get a slow train from Cambridge. And he arrived after Sissoko had handled the ball. So Spurs were already losing. I chucked him in an Uber in the 93rd minute after Origi scored. The trains were cancelled to get out. He didn't get out. The taxi queue at Cambridge Station was so long at 1:30 in the morning that he walked home. And I basically tried to kill my own dad, but all out of fact that, that I really did want to watch that game, not in the stadium, but I wanted to watch it with him because of what it means to me is my relationship with my dad and not actually really being in the stadium and watching the game. It's much more about watching it with him.
And let's not forget the joy I experienced, Max, when watching England get eliminated by Croatia in the World Cup semi-final. I mean, that's a moment I will treasure for the rest of my life, being in your company as England crashed out. I will never forget that. I loved it.
Nicky, weren't you there for the penalty shoot? Were you there for the Colombia game?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah. I suppose, Nicky, we had the Colombia game. You know, I will ignore the dance that Barry did in front of my face when Croatia knocked England out.
I watched the Colombia game in alone in a flat in Samara, and it was roasting hot. And it was this kind of quite grim flat that me, Nick Ames and Kat were sharing. And the other two weren't there. I was just sort of incredibly tense by myself.
Tony, what a beautiful way of rounding up the importance of watching football together, Wilson, sitting on your own in a cheap Russian rented flat. Look, if you want to watch football together with your friends and family, remember that on the BT Sport app, you can use the Watch Together feature to watch the upcoming UEFA Champions League semi-finals with three others on your mobile, wherever you all are in the country. And you can get all that on EE's smart plan. Search BT Sport on EE to find out more. Before we talk EFL, let's talk about the social media boycott from a lot of footballers, stakeholders, the Premier League, the EFL, the WSL, all their players will join in a four-day boycott of social media platforms in an effort to combat abuse and discrimination. Kick It Out will also be involved, as well as the FA and lots of other organisations. I'm going to do it. I don't know if you... Guys, I know Barry's going to do it. I don't know if you guys are going to do it, Jonathan and Nicky, and if you think it's a good idea and if you think it's going to make any difference.
Yeah, I am going to do it, which, you know, if I were to say score 50 or take 5 wickets next weekend will be a real test of just how committed I am to this. But no, I think as many people as possible should do it just to see if it does make any difference. Like clearly, racism is an issue that goes far beyond social media. But there is a massive and immediate problem on social media that's not being dealt with. And from everything I've heard, from you know, your conversation with Troy Townsend, for instance, it does seem it shouldn't be that complicated to stop at least some of it. So So if this can force action, well, great. And maybe it won't, maybe it will, but it's at least worth giving it a go. And the more people who give it a go, the more chance it has of working. So yes, I will be joining it.
I'm also going to do it, although in my case, I tweet so rarely at the moment that I don't think it's going to even register. I think that's the point. It only really works if the big organizations support it. Because in the end, like, social media boycott is not going to stop the idiot who wants to write something offensive from wanting to write something offensive. What you need it to do is to register with the people who run the social media companies so that they actually start taking more proactive actions. And that will only happen if it's really, really a big take up of it. So I, you know, like everyone else, I hope it works.
Yeah. And actually, you're right. It's actually not going to annoy necessarily the people who send the abuse, but it will prompt people who really go to social media to get reaction. You know, Cambridge could go up on Friday night. So a bit like Wilson, my first reaction would be to send a tweet about it. I don't actually, it doesn't actually change how much I've enjoyed Cambridge going up if we manage it or not, you know, and it's actually, you know, it's probably quite useful anyway to take 4 days off all those platforms. It should probably be a regular thing for people to do anyway. But yeah, we will support it and hopefully lots of other people will too. We're going to do the EFL properly on Wednesday's pod. Well done to Watford and Hull for getting promoted from the Championship and League One respectively. Wickham are all but down to League One. Bristol Rovers, Swindon Town relegated to League Two this weekend. Fitbar, Barry, tell us about St Johnstone and Rangers.
Yeah, the Scottish Cup quarterfinals were on over the weekend, with one still to come between Kilmarnock and St Mirren tonight. But the highlight was St Johnstone, who have already won the League Cup this season. They're now in line for the domestic double, after eliminating Rangers in excellent style. The game had gone to extra time. James Tavernier scored a header for Rangers to put them 1-0 up with 3 minutes of added or extra time remaining. And then in the second minute of added time, St Johnstone's big, burly, bearded bear of a goalkeeper, Xander Clark, came up for a corner. And he was left completely unmarked on the edge.
It's amazing, isn't it?
On the edge of the 6-yard box. And I mean, he's quite conspicuous. It's not like no one noticed he wasn't there or he was there. And the ball was sent in from the corner flag. I can't remember who took the corner, but they picked him out perfectly. And he thumped a header down towards the bottom corner. I don't know if it was going in or not, but Chris Kane was on hand to scramble the ball in at the foot of the post. And Clark, I think, thought he had scored and ran away celebrating accordingly. Absolute jubilation among the St Johnstone players to score this late equaliser. And having already made a couple of splendid saves during the game, Clark provided the assist. I'm going to say he scored the winner. He deserves it. He went on to save two penalties in the shootout from Tavernier and Kamara Roof. So St Johnstone are through to the semis, where they could face Hibs or Hibs, who beat Motherwell on penalties. Motherwell scored two late goals to bring the tie to extra time and then lost the penalty shootout. And Dundee United hammered Aberdeen, and they were given a big send-off as they left to go to Aberdeen to play the game by their fans, who turned up en masse with flares and, you know, banners to send them on their way. Mickey Mellon said that was a real nice touch by their fans. And as I said, Kilmarnock play St Mirren tonight. So, well done to St Johnstone.
Both the Women's Champions League semi-finals are pretty tight at the moment. Chelsea lost in Munich, but only 2-1, a vital away goal. And PSG Barca finished 1-1. And we'll discuss them in detail after the second leg. Serie A, Nicky, Inter pretty much wrapped up the title, haven't they? I mean, actually, the most interesting thing is especially given the whole ESL thing and Agnelli, is that Juve are not guaranteed top four by any means, are they?
Not at all. Not if they keep playing like they did at the weekend against Fiorentina either. They've been really drifting these last few weeks. This is not said with malice, because you know, he was sort of thrown into a situation that was just a bit above where he was ready to be, I think, Andrea Pirlo. But his in-game decision-making has been poor. He hasn't got a handle of the team. The team clearly is not at its highest ebb in terms of... Is that a thing? Everyone talks about lowest ebbs. Is highest ebb a thing? They're not high on confidence or morale right now. Everyone wonders if Cristiano Ronaldo even wants to be there next season, given how far away this project is from the one that he thought he signed up for. The transfer policy has been this chaotic mess of just sort of opportunity-driven signings with no thought towards building a team that is sort of coherent in its structure. So it's actually quite a sort of mess that's been building for a little while at Juventus. And as I sort of touched on earlier, I think Maurizio Sarri, for all the criticism he got for not being a very Juventus figure, did kind of paper over the cracks quite well last season. So Juventus and indeed Milan, who played Lazio tonight, who have been the two notional rivals to Inter for the title and who are the two other clubs who were involved in this Super League proposal, neither of them is at all safe in their top four spot anymore. Atalanta have moved up to second. They thumped Bologna 5-0 last night. And that is my counter, by the way, to Baz saying no football on a Sunday night. Sunday night is for Serie A, and sometimes it's great.
I meant specifically Premier League football. Spain and Italy is fine.
It's allowed.
It is really worth having a look at the top of La Liga and Liga, because those title races are absolutely brilliant. We'll talk to Sid and Philippe about those in due course. Sam says, I'm moving to London soon. Does Barry have a preferred model of water gun I should arm myself with?
Not especially. Maybe just don't live near a major live music venue.
Eddie sent this onto the pod. It's a bloke called Charlie tweeted it out. You've been murdered. Which TV detective do you want to investigate your death and why? Wilson.
I mean, it's a hard question. I feel like I've almost got too many options. I feel like Gareth Southgate, the kind of whoever I choose, I'm going to be regretting leaving three or four out.
Fair. I would definitely go whoever's the detective in Death in Paradise, because at least that meant I was having a nice time on a Caribbean island when I was killed.
No, the truth is, I don't really enjoy the heat, so I wouldn't want that, unless it's one of those Death in Paradise specials when they come back to London.
Right, okay.
I have a problem with Morse. I feel he doesn't have enough late nights by working the case. He has late nights by just drinking too much, which seems, you know, a slightly laissez-faire approach to detection that I wouldn't approve of.
I'd go for Ken Stott's Rebus, because I think Rebus and I are kind of in the same wavelength, and it would mean I'd have been murdered in Edinburgh, which is one of my favourite cities.
Yeah, well, at least if it was maybe Vera and Spender operating together, if I'd been killed in, say, Whitley Bay.
Right, okay.
by a crow out in your jog.
Yeah, or by some disaffected former punter who lost one of the meat raffles I used to run at Whitley Bay Football Club.
Oh, what was the what's top prize in a meat raffle at Whitley Bay Football Club?
Well, it's a meat packet, isn't it? So it would be a polystyrene. So I'd work the turnstiles before kickoff, yeah. Then half time.
Yeah.
You'd go around and you'd have be like a polystyrene tray,
yeah.
Which would have sort of, you know, pork chop, bit of steak, a burger, two or three sausages, a couple of tomatoes to hold the polythene up, big wedge of black pudding. And it'd be, like quid for raffle ticket.
Oh, right. So it was only one winner. It wasn't like, you know, the big prize is sort of
it was
filet
Whitley
mignon.
Bay. There's only,
then,
there's
you know,
only
you come fifth,
like 200 fans.
One fifth, you just get one Wolves banger for fifth place. Anyway, seems like we've probably done enough. Can I just say thank you to Rainer Merkel, who is a German journalist in Die Zeit, which I think is quite highbrow, wrote quite a nice article about Football Weekly in which...
I'm not so
Wilson
sure
was...
they did. They hailed Barney Ronay as possibly the world's greatest football journalist. I actually got one of my best mates' German wife to translate the pertinent part, and I'm going to say it was a very half-arsed effort. I didn't get enough praise.
Oh, that's the problem. Barney, probably the best football journalist in the world. Jonathan Wilson, supreme nerd. Max, the therapist. Barry... not described. So
no, they said I was my most endearing quality was my ability to laugh at myself. Well, very patronising.
Well, I mean, very necessary, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I haven't met you at sort of like 10:30 on a Saturday night.
Anyway,
there's also the quiz that they talked about. They got that all. It said the quiz was named eight Senegalese players for play for Tottenham. That wasn't the quiz. It was eight Senegalese goal scorers for Sam Allardyce, which is a much, much harder level of quiz. So I thought overall, I think it's probably Barney using one of his middle overpaying contacts to debase the other three of us.
Barney did forward it to me going, "This is good," to which I replied, "You're basically Carlsberg in this, aren't you, Barney?" Yes, if you do write for a highbrow newspaper in foreign climes, do write about us. Why not?
Don't blow smoke up Barney's nether regions. Yeah, don't need that.
But definitely.
He's insufferable enough already.
more articles on the pod where everyone is credited except for Barry. That's what I want. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, Singy.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back on Wednesday.
Inamoto.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.